Right. Good morning. Just a few things, because we will not retain a a video recording, but we'll maintain our typical audio recording. They'll be available to the public. And we are conducting this on Zoom. And even though we can see all of our names on the screen, the audio will not pick that up. So once the case is called, please identify yourself. I know at least one of you has been on our Zoom hearings before, so it's always better to be on gallery view so you can see the timer than speaker view. And if there are any technical problems, just flag us and let us know. I was at a judge training recently, and some of the district court judges shared some really surprising stories about how informal some people were. The not lawyers, but some of the parties appearing, and what they were not wearing. But you are both dressed in very appropriate office attire today, so I'm glad to report. All right, with that, let's get started. Marshall, will you call the case?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals
We're having some audio issues, so I think I'll just go ahead and do that. So our first case on our oral calendar this morning is the case of State of Minnesota versus Amy Christine Lukes Quinn. It is appeal number A20-0460. And this session of the Court of Appeals is now in order. And as you know, the appellant will have 15 minutes, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant will have 5 minutes at the end for rebuttal. Please start and identify your name for the record.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Gina Schultz. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent Amy Lukes Quinn, the appellant in this matter. There are two issues before this court today, but I'm going to focus primarily on the first, which is whether the district court abused its discretion by admitting hearsay evidence without requiring the state to prove that it was either necessary or reliable. Because the evidence was admitted in violation of Lukes Quinn's constitutional rights, and because it was not harmless, this court must reverse the order revoking her probation.
So, counsel, can I just jump in with an overall question in terms of the prejudice prong? We're familiar when there's a plain error issue what the standard is for prejudice, but this is plain error coupled with the constitutional allegation. So what do you think the standard is for prejudice that we should be applying?
I think if the state cannot carry its burden to show that the error was harmless, then this court should reverse. Consistent with similar, I think the analogy here is to an evidentiary problem at a trial where this court would remand for a new trial if the state wasn't able to demonstrate that it was harmless.
But are you saying that's where it stops, or also harmless beyond a reasonable doubt as the constitutional standard for prejudice?
I mean, I think because there are constitutional issues at play here, harmless beyond a reasonable doubt is an appropriate standard.
And do you agree that plain error is the proper standard of review?
I do not, Your Honor. Because Lukes Quinn did object at the hearing, and I understand that the objection was hearsay, and the parties didn't litigate specifically Johnson or Morrissey. But I think under this court's case law and under the Supreme Court case law, that objection was adequate. And so I want to address the case that this court relied on in Williams when it found that a similar objection wasn't adequate. And in that case, I think it's really, that's State v. Rosberg from the Minnesota Supreme Court. And that case is really distinguishable for two reasons. One is that it was a trial. And so a hearsay objection could indicate either a constitutional objection or an objection under the rules of evidence. But because this was a probation revocation hearing, the only possible limitation on hearsay is a constitutional one. And so from the context, that's all she could have meant. I think the other distinction between this case and Rosberg is that in that case, the attorney specifically litigated it as a hearsay objection under the rules of evidence at the trial court, and then on appeal changes theory. And that's just not what's happening here. Lucas Quinn's attorney objected. The objection was timely. I think it included all the information that was needed to trigger an analysis under Johnson and Morrissey. And so I think the error was preserved here for appellate review.
So I've got a quick question. Do we even need to reach that issue in this case? Because we have the police officer testifying about the incident with alcohol use that resulted in the October 14 probation revocation report. So do we even need to get into the hearsay issue? I mean, isn't that enough in and of itself? The first, without even looking at the supplemental violation report.
I think this court does have to reach that issue because there is prejudice here, especially especially to the extent that the state cannot prove that it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think that prejudice comes in primarily in two ways. The first is that the district court did find violation based on this, two independent violations based on this hearsay evidence alone. And the state didn't produce any other evidence regarding that October 18th arrest. And the district court did find violation. But second, the hearsay evidence really did prop up some weaknesses in the state's evidence regarding the first set of allegations regarding the contact with police on October 8th. And there, the state did produce a live witness, but that witness's testimony was significantly undermined on cross-examination. Lucas Quinn's counsel was able to bring out some inconsistencies, some omissions, and in fact, caught the witness in what appeared to be either an inaccuracy or a lie regarding whether Lucas Quinn had given her consent to enter her apartment. And so, and in fact, the district—
But there's no appeal on that issue. I mean, that, right? And there is, and the district court found the officer credible. And there is no disputed evidence that the officer at least smelled alcohol. I know you've suggested in your brief that the body cam video brings into question whether or not her words were slurred. So what do we do with that? I mean, we have to find clear error then, correct?
I disagree, Your Honor, because I think, I mean, given, I don't think we can challenge, you know, the sufficiency of the evidence supporting that violation here. But I think where it's important is that the hearsay evidence on the second set of allegations really propped up some weaknesses in the first. And you mentioned the smell of alcohol that wasn't in her initial police report. And in fact, the district court telegraphed some concerns with Officer Emmonson's testimony in that case when, after she testified, the district court judge asked the probation officer, okay, if I don't think there's enough evidence on this first set of allegations, would you change your mind? And the probation officer responded that no, he wouldn't. And the district court followed up, are you sure? And in the end, the district court did find Officer Amundson credible. But I think this second allegation, this hearsay evidence, did affect or could have affected her credibility finding regarding the officer, even though her credibility had been undermined on cross-examination.
Based on this record and what one might reasonably anticipate on a remand, assuming we agreed with you on this issue but disagreed with you on your second issue, What would you suppose would happen in a remanded hearing?
Well, Your Honor, I think there's probably a range of options here, but I think the analogy to an evidentiary issue in a criminal trial is appropriate, where a new trial would be appropriate. I think a new revocation hearing would be as
right.
Well.
No, I understand that. I'm just trying to envision how in any universe the result would be different.
Well, I'm in. I cited one of this court's unpublished decisions in my primary brief, and that was State v. Kellogg. And in that case, this court said remanded to the district court to consider whether revocation was still the appropriate decision without the erroneously admitted evidence. And
well, I would suppose that in this case, since you're challenging an evidentiary decision, that we would remand in the, as you've asked in your brief, for a new revocation hearing where the state could then introduce whatever evidence is necessary, could bolster, provide some foundation and provide the same hearsay evidence or produce a live witness. I'm just trying to, and this is one of those cases where it's tough to see the end game looking any different for your client, frankly. And when I look at this record, I'm wondering whether the district court's revocation decision to revoke your client's probation, it's one of those moments where it may have saved your client's life and others' lives. I'm just trying to envision how you would expect this to play out any differently.
Well, I guess the record that we have sort of demonstrates how it could play out differently. So when Officer Amundson testified, it exposed a lot of Lucas Counsel's cross-examination was able to expose a lot of weaknesses in her initial assessment. And it's certainly possible that if the state called the arresting officer, the arresting officer would provide credible testimony that would be adverse to Lucas Quinn, and the result wouldn't be any different. But it's also possible that the state would call that live witness, and through cross-examination, more holes would be exposed. And I think
what I hear Judge Ross saying is, in terms of the violations, there are some of these that you don't dispute, like the history of probation, right? And those things would usually weigh in favor of the need for confinement. So what is it about the hearsay testimony that if the state wasn't able, for example, to present a live witness and that evidence is out, is it simply using, again, is it the repeated use that you think would then move the needle from an executed sentence to continuing someone on probation? What is it about the hearsay evidence that you think would change the outcome? And maybe it is use. I don't know.
I certainly think so, Your Honor. When you look at the district court's order, use is clearly the driving factor. And there are other, the district court did find violation on other allegations, but use is the important thing. And I think it's not just that it's a second instance of use, it's also that the state had this narrative about Lucas Quinn throughout the whole proceedings. There's always kind of this question of whether she's evading tests to cover up her use, or if she's just as genuinely having a lot of trouble with transportation and with, she has medical issues that cause diluted UAs. And I think this hearsay evidence, especially considering the district court's concerns about Officer Amundson's testimony, I think it's enough to move the needle, because it really does, it really shores up the state's narrative about her and really destroys the reports that she has made to the court. And I think—
So what evidence is there of use other than the police report?
We don't have, in this instance, we don't have a UA, we don't have any direct evidence of her, with possessing alcohol. I'd say the closest thing that we have is that in the body camera video from Officer Amundson, she does say that that she and her husband had been at a bar that evening, but she didn't say that she'd been drinking, and we don't have any positive tests. And so really what we have two separate officers, both making somewhat subjective observations about her. And one officer's observations were undercut on cross-examination, and the other are sort of formalized in this statement and allowed to stand. And
so can I interrupt? So the first, I think it's October 8th, where it's a DWI call or something, some kind of disturbance, whatever, is the reason the police are there. And I understand it's not in the police report that the officer thought that your client was intoxicated. Again, that's not the purpose of the call. And then, you know, she does say on the body cam video, however, that it appears that both of them are intoxicated.
Yes, I agree that her observation is in that video.
So that's in real time. I mean, that, you know, I guess I don't know what my question is, but it doesn't seem significant to me that it was not in the police report in that first call. If they've been called out there for probation revocation or, you know, the probation arrest, like in the second call, then if it was not in the report, I would draw more from it. But so how do we deal with that inconsistency? I mean, when the judge found her credible and she was there to testify, I mean, isn't that enough combined with, you know, the other violations, which don't seem contested, and that this was her sixth kind of go round? I guess I'm asking the same thing that Judge Ross did. What's going to be different this time around? You know, and isn't that enough? And what, is there any case law or any other authority that says, well, even if we throw out the hearsay, even if we throw out portions of the judge's findings that we think under the case law, there's still enough there to have revoked her?
I see that I'm running out of time.
Well, you maybe on rebuttal then, in your rebuttal time. Okay, thank you so much. And Ms. Cornell, is that the right way to pronounce your name?
Yes, Judge Cornell.
Oh, great, okay, why don't you go ahead and identify yourself for the record and begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Nicole Cornell. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, excuse me, appearing on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota. In this case, the district court did not plainly err or abuse its discretion in deciding to revoke appellant's probation and execute her 42-month sentence after, as Judge Siegel said, her sixth set of probation violations was found by the district court. This court should affirm the district court's decision. And I will keep my argument brief based on the panel's questions for counsel this morning. But as the panel has already stated or alluded to, the plain error standard of review applies in this case because below, appellant did not preserve any constitutional objections on the record. And that is so because this court has determined in Rosberg and sort of a carbon copy of the facts of this case in this court's unpublished decision in Williams. So Rosberg and Williams clearly explain why the plain error standard of review applies here. If I could be precise on exactly what appellant's trial counsel objected to on the record, the hearsay that appellant's counsel objected to below was the probation officer's addendum, which was filed the day of the contested Morrissey hearing in this case. So the probation officer filed an addendum. In the addendum is one paragraph. It's an additional violation alleging a second instance of use on October 18th, which is the day that appellant was arrested on the October 14th probation violation. And I apologize for all the use of dates. I can clarify as we go. But to be clear, appellant did not object to the district court's acceptance of that addendum. Within the addendum was a summary of the police reports of that arrest. Appellant never objected to the addendum being entered into the district court record below. What appellant did object to below was probation officer Burton's testimony regarding the police reports that he summarized in his addendum, which the court had already accepted, if that makes sense. So the words that appellant's counsel used below was, it's, quote, it's double hearsay and I don't have that body camera. That is a blanket hearsay objection, which did not preserve the issues of the Confrontation Clause violations under the Sixth Amendment, or as Morrissey discusses, the confrontation rights under due process. It preserved neither of those.
And the argument that because the rules of evidence are so clear, hearsay not applying to probation revocation hearings, the argument that in that context, if you make a hearsay objection, the only possible thing you could be saying is this is a Confrontation Clause issue through the Due Process Clause of the U.S. Constitution. Not a rules of evidence issue.
Your Honor, that is not clear from the record below. The record states it's double hearsay and I don't have that body camera.
I'm just saying from once an attorney makes that objection and the judge is hearing that objection, the only valid basis for an objection, it's not the rules of evidence. It's the right to confront a witness, right?
And Your Honor, I'm saying that's not clear. I'm saying that the district court can't read the mind of an appellant, or in this case, the probationer who objects to blanket hearsay. And that is so because there are confrontation clause rights under the Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution. There's, as Morrissey discusses, a separate a right to confrontation under the Due Process Clause. How is the district court supposed to read people's minds and say, when they say hearsay, do they mean this? Do they mean that? Do they mean just blanket hearsay? And the district court moved right along with the hearing because, as the prosecutor noted, the rules prohibiting hearsay don't apply to probation revocation hearings. So I hope that answers your question, Judge.
Well, in part. I mean, I think that there is some validity to the argument that you're making that the objection wasn't more precise. At the same time, I'm not making much of a distinction between what the due process clause might in the Sixth Amendment versus the due process in the 14th Amendment. I'm not making that distinction. I think that the U.S. Constitution, although I don't think it uses the words right to confront witnesses or confrontation clause, the U.S. Constitution guarantees witnesses or defendants at a probation violation hearing the right to confront witnesses. And it does apply in some form to those. And I'm looking at not just the state Supreme Court cases, but also interpretations of the U.S. Constitution, such as what the Eighth Circuit has done in supervised release revocation hearings and parole revocation hearings. And it's very clear. If you're applying the constitutional right to confront in a probation or supervised release revocation context, there is a balancing test that the district court must do. And on one side of that balancing test is the reason why there's no witness. And on the other side is the testimony itself. But we don't have a reason why there's no witness here. And there are cases, including from the Eighth Circuit, applying the constitutional right to confront in exactly that context and concluding that when you have an absence of a reason for the absence of the witness, that is reversible. So I think it is a really important question to look at. The constitutional right to confront requires a balancing test that the rules of evidence don't require. And so if you're making this objection and the only possible basis for it is the constitutional standard, then the district court is committing error, call it regular error, plain error, doesn't matter. That's error not to apply the balancing test.
Your Honor, I appreciate that that is an important discussion to be had. It is not before this court today because the particular, well, let me just start with this. I agree with Your Honor that generally speaking, in a non-probation revocation circumstance, that there is a constitutional right to confront witnesses against a particular defendant. However, in the rules regarding probation revocation proceeding, those rights are substantially limited. That's why there's a whole separate test in the Morrissey world of good cause. Is there good cause to not, I'm losing my words here, but there is a right for a probationer to assert they want to cross-examine a particular person. That is true. That is an important question. That is not the question that's before this court today because the general hearsay objection did not preserve that issue on appeal. That is why plain error is the standard of review here. So I agree with Your Honor that that is an important question, but it's not the question before this court.
So
but,
had the attorney below said confrontation clause, you would be conceding that this needs to be reversed?
I am not conceding that, Your Honor.
Okay, then what was the balancing test that the district court applied? There isn't one, right? There's no reason, there's no good cause for the absence given.
If I could have just a little bit of leeway to go down a very shallow rabbit hole, Your Honors. So I have spent way too many hours looking into precisely how district courts in Minnesota handle this type of issue. Okay, so below, the district court had before it a blanket hearsay objection, hearsay, double hearsay, something like that. So when the district court is set with a blanket hearsay objection, and then the response from the prosecutor is hearsay doesn't apply in these types of proceedings, the district court appropriately overruled that objection. And then moved on with the hearing. So let's talk about how this would look differently if this particular appellant did object and say confrontation clause rights. That still isn't enough because confrontation clause rights, as was discussed in Johnson in the footnotes, the confrontation clause rights under the Sixth Amendment is slightly different than the confrontation clause under the due process. And it's not before this court to go into exactly why, and I'm not sure I have a great answer for you on why the analysis is different, but it is. So in order to preserve the arguments that appellant now makes on appeal, it's respondent's position that they should have objected, Your Honor, hearsay, due process confrontation clause violation under the due process rights that appellant has. And that would bring it into the Morrissey world instead of the Johnson-Williams world, if that makes sense. So that's two separate questions before this court. There's one question before this court, and that regards the district court's decision regarding hearsay. And there is a separate topic to be discussed at some point in time, not important to this case, about what Judge Bryan had mentioned. I apologize for interrupting Judge Siegel.
No. I'm glad you finished your response. So setting aside what the standard of review is, how do you respond? Appellant's counsel said, no, we can't set aside the hearsay issue and just not deal with it because the judge, district court, found a persistent failure to abstain from alcohol. And so how do you respond to that? Can we separate these out or not? And then I want to get back to actually answer that second. My first question is this. On the second violation where the officers go to arrest pursuant to the probation revocation warrant, that goes for, I mean, relying on a police report and not having the officer there, that goes further than Johnson, doesn't it? And the Johnson court, in fact, in terms of the confrontation clause and allowing that to satisfy the state's clear and convincing evidence burden. Because Johnson, in fact, the court said, well, the hearsay part of this was kind of a collateral issue. It wasn't the central problem in Johnson. You know, so therefore it's okay. And, you know, we the hearsay is okay there. But here, I mean, if we're going to use that second failing to abstain from alcohol, just allowing the police report without bringing the officer in, I mean, do you agree that goes further than Johnson under the Confrontation Clause? Obviously, the rules of evidence are one thing, but the Confrontation Clause, the constitutional rights.
Your Honor, I'm not sure I'm entirely understanding your question.
I don't blame you.
I apologize for that, but I just want to be clear. The police reports were not entered regarding the October 18th arrest on appellant's probation violations. It's in fact the addendum to the probation officer's initial violation report. And in that addendum is a summary of what he read in the police reports.
Right.
And the probation officer didn't testify about those particular events because...
Right. So here's my question. It's a two-part question. I'll try to be more clear. Is that, one, what's your response to the question of whether we can ignore the second incident and just not deal with hearsay? And then, or the Confrontation Clause. And then second, if we just assume that we can't, how does that satisfy the clear and convincing evidence? I mean, it, you know, under the Confrontation Clause, isn't that a constitutional violation? Didn't the prosecution, and in fact, in Johnson, the prosecution was allowed, the state was allowed a continuance to bring in the officer to prove, you know, the grounds that the person was under the influence at the time. So you only have a minute left. So how, let's just deal with the first question. How do you respond to appellant's counsel saying that no, we do have to deal with the October 14th, I think, the second incident?
My response is, of course, this court can separate the two. And in fact, the district court did so. If this court reviews the district court's order revoking appellant's probation in this case, it will see that regarding the October 8th violations, which is the domestic violence call that Judge Siegel was discussing before, in that paragraph, the district court says, I find these things, I find this officer credible, I conclude that use occurred because of what she witnessed on the body camera, and the substantial corroborating evidence surrounding that. There's no interlock ignition blows. The officer was credible in that the officer made impressions, present sense impressions on the body camera, and wrote a report about it. And I realize I'm out of time, but of course, this court can separate the two. The district court did so. And if this court compares the findings regarding the October 8th use allegation and the October 18th use allegation, you will see the difference between the two. And it is clear that the district court did not rely much on that. And if this court does get to the effect on substantial rights analysis, and I'm maybe 20 seconds from being done, so if I could have
finish
a little
up,
leeway. Thank you, Your Honor. There just is no reasonable probability that Judge Tu in this case would not have revoked appellant's probation, but for the hearsay upon which appellant now complains prejudiced her, considering appellant's very checkered history on probation. Appellant received a guideline sentence but violated her probation numerous times in numerous sets of ways, and it's clear that the district court's order revoking her probation should be affirmed in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Schultz, you have 5 minutes. Oh, you're on mute. The joys of Zoom.
Sorry about that. I want to start by answering Judge Siegel's question that I wasn't able to answer on at the beginning. I understand the concern that there is enough here to revoke We're obviously arguing that there's not, but I understand that. I think the problem is that when there's erroneously admitted evidence, it's an impact analysis. It's not just, is it sufficient? Is there sufficient evidence here to revoke her probation? That's the wrong question. The wrong question is, what kind of impact did this evidence have on Judge Chu's decision to reverse or to revoke? And I think possibly quite a bit, especially given that she did telegraph some concerns about Officer Amundson's testimony, suggested that maybe there wasn't clear and convincing evidence of use in that instance, and then ended up relying on the circumstances of the October 18th arrest, and the only evidence of that was this hearsay testimony, to find violation. And here it is true that Lucas Quinn has had a checkered history on probation. She struggled, and she has never denied that. But at the same time, she has completed numerous inpatient treatment programs. She stayed in touch with her agent. She's had a lot of trauma and homelessness and mental health issues that she's had to deal with. And the fact is, Judge Chu hasn't revoked her in the past because of that. The district court has given her chances to continue working through her treatment. And in fact, the probation officer here testified that it is completely normal for someone with substance use problems to have 6 or 7 goes at treatment before it really takes. And he also testified that when there's someone with a history of trauma, that it can be even longer.
Can you speak to, I'm sorry, I don't want you to lose all of your time before you address the question of issue preservation.
If I could jump on that, if the objection had been hearsay and the response had been, no, it's not hearsay because it goes to state of mind of the listener, or for whatever reason, definitionally, it is not hearsay, and the court believed that, that's a very different analysis. And if that was the end of it, there would be no confrontation clause issue. If the district court had said, yes, I'll apply the rules of evidence, I'll apply the hearsay rules, and under those rules, it's still admitted because it's an exception or it's a definitional not hearsay. Those are very different things, right? And so if that had been the response, it's hard now to say that issue was preserved on a confrontation clause issue if they had actually done some hearsay analysis. So I want you to address this question, as Judge Ross had put it, and what is it about the words that were used that would preserve a constitutional confrontation clause objection?
Yeah, I guess I have a couple of answers to that, Your Honor. And the first is that if they had litigated the, you know, definitions of hearsay back and forth more clearly, we would be in a situation that's a little more analogous to Rosberg, even though in that case it was a criminal trial rather than probation revocation proceedings. In this case, there wasn't that kind of in-depth analysis.
Why is it necessary, though? I mean, as I look at hearsay, there's sort of the concept of hearsay exists apart from the rules of evidence. The concept of hearsay exists apart from the confrontation clause. I've been in many administrative hearings where the rules of evidence don't apply, but there's still an objection based upon hearsay. And the question goes to the reliability of the evidence, and fact finders can exclude evidence based upon unreliability because of hearsay outside of the rules. So in this case, there's an objection that's made on hearsay grounds, and the colloquy that goes back and forth is just, well, the rules don't apply, and then it gets dropped. It seems to me that one way to interpret that exchange is, well, there's an objection based upon hearsay, a response that says you shouldn't consider that because this proceeding is outside those rules. And there, it seems to me, the moment where a litigant would say, no, well, there's one more issue. There's the confrontation hearsay problem that we have to deal with. But that didn't happen here. So going back to Judge Bryan's concern, I have a separate concern that the issue just wasn't preserved. Can you address that? And I know my question's taken you over your time. Hopefully Judge Siegel will give you a little leeway.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. I guess I have two answers to that. The first is that if that's the kind of specificity that's required at trial court, I think trial counsel really needs notice that that's the kind of exchange we need whenever there's going to be some kind of objection. And,
well, I differ. Just to push back on that, my concern is doesn't the court need to know? Doesn't the court have to have some notice that it needs to analyze differently from just, no, this is outside the rules, so we're not going to go any further? Doesn't the court need to know, wait a minute, I'm being directed to a constitutional analysis, not just the controlling rule analysis?
Well, Your Honor, I agree that the district court needs notice, but I think the district court had notice in both in Morrissey and Gagnon and Johnson. These are old cases that have been settled law in Minnesota and in the federal courts for a long time. And under that settled law, if there's an objection the only limitation to hearsay evidence at probation revocation hearings is a constitutional one. And I think in this case, the exchange was not nearly as linear as you might hope. If you look at the transcript, there's an objection, and then the district court is asking some clarifying questions about another issue, and it kind of goes back and forth for a little bit, and then the district court moves on. And I think in this context, the objection was clear because it's the only thing that it could have been, that a hearsay objection could have been referring to. So under Rosberg, under the rules of evidence, I think that was adequate.
All right, so, and any further questions, Judge Brian, Judge Ross? All right, well, thank you very much. Your briefs and oral arguments are very helpful to us. And this case is now submitted, and we will issue an opinion within the statutory timeline. Thank you both.
Thank you.